Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The opioid epidemic has become a big and ever-present news story, as overdoses of the addictive medications have become a leading cause of death in the United States. According to the Department of Health and Human Services, there were more than 40,000 deaths due to opioids in 2016, and more than 2 million Americans with an opioid use disorder. Some towns in the U.S. have seen their economies destroyed by opioid abuse, including a town in Ohio where Vicodin pills replaced cash as the local currency, according to the award-winning book Dreamland. My guest today, Reggie Whitten, is a lawyer who will serve as co-lead counsel for the state of Oklahoma in an upcoming lawsuit against four different pharmaceutical firms. Oklahoma's attorney general is suing the firms for deceptive marketing practices, among other claims. At present, the firms all deny liability. Whitten lost his son Brandon to opioid addiction in 2002 when he was killed in a car crash. In spite of several attempts at rehabilitation, Brandon was not able to shake his addiction to opioids. Digging out from his grief, Reggie Whitten has started a foundation devoted to educating the public about the dangers of opioids, in addition to another project that brings Oklahoma students and professionals to help school children in Uganda in the aftermath of civil war there with the infamous Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army. Reggie Whitten, co-lead lawyer in Oklahoma's lawsuit against opioid manufacturers, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Reggie Whitten, welcome to Medical Monday. You are involved as a co-lead lawyer in Oklahoma's lawsuit against opioid manufacturers. How did you come to be involved in that?
Well, thanks for having me, John. Attorney General Mike Hunter hired my law firm, Michael Burridge, and I, along with another lawyer. The three of us will be co-lead counsel for the trial. The trial is set in May of 2019. It'll be the first state in the country to go to trial against Big Pharma. And I think General Hunter chose my law firm because of our law experience, but also because Mike Burridge lost his niece to opioids, and I lost my son to opioids. And so I think that that's probably one of the major factors that caused him to associate us to help him in this lawsuit.
So this won't go for about another year, you're saying? So
yes, May of 2019.
Wow. Why does it take so long?
It is a rather large lawsuit. I can tell you the defense feels like that's way too early, and we feel like it's way too late. We'd like to go to trial next month, but there's a lot of moving parts.
Okay, and you mentioned the personal tragedy. You said he lost a son. Will you share about that?
Yeah, I talk all over the state about it. In 2002, my son Brandon died in a vehicular accident that was really caused, or in my humble opinion, by him getting addicted to prescription drugs, and opioids was the primary driver in that. A couple of years before that, he actually had an automobile accident and killed his girlfriend. That was in 1999. And that was my first experience with addiction. I had no idea what an addict was, and I really grew up watching Andy Griffith and Mayberry and Otis the Town Drunk, and that is really what I thought an addict was. I thought it was bad people doing bad things. My son was, the homecoming king at Westmore High School. He was a football star. He was a good student. He was well-liked by everybody and really was a very good kid, played college football, no trouble. And then he got introduced by some of his friends to the concept of taking prescription drugs. My son didn't have a prescription from a doctor. These were people either passing them around or selling them or both. So, one night I get a phone call and I'm told that he has had a car accident. And so by the time I get to the hospital, I see his girlfriend. We thought she was going to make it. She ultimately did not. And my son was hurt pretty seriously. And, of course, one of the drugs they ended up giving him in the hospital were opioids. He got a very serious injury, but, he got exposed to downers. That's what he called them, downers, prior to getting his injury in that car accident. And that's what led to it. And so that was our first funeral, was his girlfriend. And all of a sudden, this kid who had, really never had a parking ticket was now looking at potentially at manslaughter charges. The only thing that kept him from getting them was the family of this young lady was truly amazing, and they loved Brandon, and they knew he loved her. And so he got another chance, but for the next 3 years, I learned a lot about addiction because he told me what happened, and he had started, but he couldn't stop. And that's what made me start talking to schools around the state was he told me, Dad, if I had known I couldn't stop, I never would have started.
When Brandon had that first car accident involving his girlfriend, was he or was your family able to acknowledge that there was a problem at that point, medically speaking, or was it still sort of things had come to a head and, you know, we were so lucky he was still alive and he was recovering, so we didn't really kind of address it as a real problem or didn't know it was a problem or going to be a problem at that point?
Well, first, you know, I'm a native Oklahoman from Seminole. When I grew up, we had pretty much beer and, you know, there wasn't anything called prescription drug abuse, as far as I knew. And yeah, there was a learning curve there because when I found out what happened to Brandon, I tell you what I did. I just told him to stop. This kid had great willpower. He was a good student, college student, great college athlete, won a national championship in football, Division II. And I mean, he could do all the right things until he got addicted. And I had trouble believing that. I think he had trouble believing that. He was a big, strong kid. And how can a big, strong kid from a good family end up becoming a slave to a drug? It didn't make sense to either one of us, really. But as time went by, I began to learn about this. We had plenty of willpower. We had plenty of money to get medical treatment. We didn't know where to go or what to do, and we began learning about it. I sent him to several rehabs, in-state and out-of-state. I talked to my family doctor. I found out later, sadly, 90% of the med schools in this country don't really teach the science of addiction the way it should be taught. And we're cranking out doctors all over the country who really aren't taught much about addiction per se. Obviously, they know something about it. And you're a doctor. You know what I'm talking about. But they don't know as much as they need to know. My family doctor now, I know, was seriously remiss in not being able to advise me on a number of things because he didn't know. And he essentially had bought into the mantra that my son needed to use more willpower and I needed to use more tough love. So you fast forward 3 years of failed experiments and not knowing where to go. For example, I did not know that the efficacy of a 30-day rehab was about 10%. Nobody told me that. And they're not going to market it that way.
No, they're not going to market it. I mean,
who would ever buy a product that only works 10% of the time and a very expensive product, too? I can tell you now, I have other children. I would rather my children have AIDS every day, all day, than addiction, because it's easier to treat AIDS. Addiction is a very strange disease. It masquerades as bad behavior, but it's not. Obviously, you know, people across the board can behave badly. My son went down the path that many people go down, have a beer, have a drink, have a pill. He never thought any of them could grab him up and get him on the hook like a fish. And indeed, the alcohol didn't, but the pills did. So you fast forward to 2002, and he ended up dying in another vehicular accident. I was actually chasing him at the time because I was still using tough love that my doctor had told me to use.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know, I've got quite a bit of survivor guilt over that, but, you know, it is what it is. So after he died, I formed a foundation called Fighting Addiction Through Education, and I think education is the key. So I'll tell you a little about education. We know now that addiction is a disease. We would never tell a diabetic, stop using insulin and use more willpower.
No, it sounds ludicrous on its face, yeah.
It would be insane. And, you know, we certainly, I'll tell you another thing, when somebody gets cancer or, you know, some other terrible disease, they don't have a stigma of shame. In fact, most people feel sorry for someone who has cancer. But when you are addicted, everybody looks at you different. It is shameful. When your son dies of addiction, the general public looks at you in a manner in which they think you must be ashamed. And indeed, I felt a lot of shame. I don't now because my son got sick. And our country really wasn't very familiar with addiction and what to do with it. And our medical profession wasn't either. I'm not blaming doctors. In fact, ironically, in this lawsuit, I'm taking up for doctors. I am, though, blaming the very dangerous characteristics of these drugs and the fact that so many of us don't have any idea how dangerous they are. But the bottom line is this: if you're going to pick up a snake, you better know the difference between a garden snake and a cobra. There's a big difference. And opioids are more akin to a cobra than they are a garden snake. They are a particularly dangerous drug. And that's what led to this opioid epidemic.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Reggie Whitten, who is a lawyer in Oklahoma City. He's also the co-lead lawyer in Oklahoma's lawsuit against pharma, against opioid manufacturers, which was the first to go through and will be litigated about a year from now and is in the discovery process right now. And Reggie, you were telling me that there's quite a number of attorneys on both sides of this case working. I mean, how many are on the defense and how many, I mean, that you know of, I guess, are on the plaintiff side?
It's a very labor-intensive case on both sides, and both sides are pretty well armed with some pretty good lawyers. I think on the plaintiff side, we've got probably 20-25 lawyers working, not full-time, but pretty close to full-time. And on the defense side, I'd say it's quite a bit larger than that. It's a very labor-intensive and a very expensive lawsuit. It is one of the largest lawsuits in the country, and I'll be happy to tell you why. This is the largest man-made epidemic in the history of this country. It is a trillion-dollar problem for the country.
In terms of when you total it all up, in terms of lost productivity and the medical costs and all that?
Well, if the people that caused this epidemic never paid a dime for the people that they killed and the people they harmed, it's still a trillion-dollar problem to the states, to the other entities that have to pick up the pieces. So let me shift to Oklahoma. Oklahoma taxpayers have to pick up all kinds of costs associated with the opioid epidemic. They've got to pay for as much treatment as they can afford to give. Sadly, the state cannot treat everybody that needs treatment. There's a long line of people who are addicted and they have nowhere to go. But 80% of the crime in this state is caused or contributed to in a major way by this epidemic. I can give you some other numbers. If you just look at one of the main metrics, it's deaths. Now, probably for every death, there's probably close to 1,000 people who have not died yet, and some of them probably never will die. They'll simply live their lives miserable. Some of them may get well, but sadly, without treatment, it's very, very difficult and very, very rare, and there's not enough treatment. But in terms of metrics, I think we lost close to 60,000 people in the Vietnam War the whole time. And yet last, I think it was 2016, we lost more than that to drug overdoses. That's the first time that had ever happened in this country.
And the first time, and it exceeded the number of motor vehicle accidents as well, deaths from motor vehicle accidents.
Exactly right. Yeah. Motor vehicle accidents, even when I was a kid, and I'm 63, have always been the leading cause of death. But now we have a totally new game in town. And this, you know, this isn't the first drug epidemic that our country has had. You know, we've had, there was a crack cocaine epidemic at one time and a heroin epidemic. Neither of those really hit Oklahoma. But there's epidemics, and then there's epidemics. The numbers for the cocaine epidemic and the heroin epidemic are tiny when compared to the opioid epidemic. It's pretty much a flat line, the use of opioids, going back as far as we have records. And we've had opioids, as you know, for thousands of years. They've been around forever. And everybody knew that they were very addictive. Opioids actually are a very helpful drug for either end-of-life care on one end of the spectrum. You know, if you're dying of cancer, it's a very helpful drug. On the other hand, for short-term acute injuries, you're in a car wreck or you fell out of your treehouse and broke your leg, or you had to go in the hospital and have a hip replacement surgery, opioids are very helpful on that. And they've been used forever. But in 1996, something new happened that was unprecedented. Purdue Pharmaceutical, a small company, all of a sudden began marketing opioids for something in the middle of those two points on the continuum. They began marketing opioids for long-term pain, for backaches, neck aches, migraines, fibromyalgia, everything in between those two points on the continuum. And all of a sudden, the charts and graphs, their sales start rocketing up. But when you put on a graph, deaths and treatment for addiction, they move in a parallel line. All three of these things go almost parallel. It's very uncanny when you see them. And that proves causation. That proves that it was their sales and marketing that caused the deaths and the overdoses and the addiction. And so it has risen almost every year since. And now we're starting to see it taper off a little bit, but that's, I can talk about that too. There's a reason for that. The CDC, Center for Disease Control, has begun to see the bodies pile up, and they've issued new guidelines, really trying to get us back to the old way doctors did it. Don't prescribe opioids for anything other than short-term acute or long-term end-of-life care, and get away from this everything in the middle. There are better drugs and better things to do. And so it is the world's largest opioid epidemic, man-made and entirely unnecessary.
So this is a speculative question, and it may get into your legal strategy that you know you don't want to share or aren't ready to talk about yet. But if you're talking about those graphs, I'm going to assume that Purdue Pharma, for example, or these other pharma companies know that, well, one assumes anyway, that they knew that their sales and marketing was going up and that there was a problem. It makes me ask, you know, didn't they know that the number of deaths were going up, or was there just, you know, follow the money and there's just willful denial, maybe not even maliciously, not even evil, just, hey, we're making so much money and we think we're treating pain in a good sense. We're you know, I mean, maybe you are trying to show that they did it with malintent.
John, I don't think it's going to be very difficult to prove that Purdue did it with intent. In fact, they ultimately got charged with some federal charges for misbranding one of their drugs and pled guilty to knowingly, with intent to deceive, marketing these drugs. So I think it's going to be pretty easy to prove what they did. Aside from that, I think we'll be able to prove that they can't and they didn't turn a blind eye to what we're talking about here. They had to have known. It is my belief they had to have known that we were in the midst of an opioid epidemic, or that we would be in one, even going back to 95 before this happened. Because the characteristics of opioids, this isn't new. Everybody's always known that they're highly addictive. But they came out with this first drug, OxyContin, and Purdue claimed that it was rarely addictive. It was addictive in only 1% of the cases. But we now can prove that they never had any scientific evidence to support that. They never did then, and they don't today. What really happened was, through a brilliant marketing campaign, they began to do a number of things. They basically are the ones that came up with the idea to really recruit people to sell these drugs and promote them.
And those were doctors or just detailers or both?
These would be drug pharmaceutical reps.
Representatives, okay.
There's nothing wrong per se with being a pharmacy rep at all, but there is something wrong when you lie to the doctors in this country. That's what I meant when I said we're actually going to take up for the doctors, because we believe they were definitely misled by the manufacturers, primarily probably Purdue. But the doctors were lied to, and they went out and spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, Big Pharma did, finding and setting up foundations and associations. The American Pain Foundation is one. They funded these things. They spent enormous amounts of money to spread the word that opioids were not addictive, and it worked. And our position is that doctors in this modern day, they have to rely upon the manufacturers to some extent for scientific data, and they've been doing that for a long time, but it's just not right to lie to the doctors and claim that opioids are not addictive. And that's what they did, primarily initially because they claimed it was time-released. OxyContin was a time-release drug. Maybe that'll make it less addictive. But they had no evidence of it, and indeed, it's highly addictive. And as a result, tens of thousands of people have died, hundreds of thousands of people, and even more will die into the future, because once you get this train going downhill at breakneck speed, it is really difficult to stop it.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. Our guest today is Reggie Witten, who is a lawyer in Oklahoma City with the law firm Witten & Burridge. He and his law partner are co-lead lawyers on Oklahoma's lawsuit against the opioid manufacturers, which is going to be litigated about a year from now in May of 2019. And Reggie, what do you envision? I mean, it sounds like you have pretty compelling and sort of damning evidence about their marketing practices. And as you mentioned earlier, they've already pled guilty essentially to a federal charge, which I guess would certainly seem to help your case. Do you think in the end they're just going to settle and there will be a big pot of money? Or, they're not going to want to necessarily, I guess, get taken to the cleaners. I mean, if you're able to prove, and again, I am, believe me, no lawyer, but if you're able to prove, you know, harm that they've caused and, you know, these hundreds of thousands of lives that have been devastated by the rise in opioid use and, you know, deceiving marketing practices, I mean, ultimately a jury, is it a jury trial? Will a jury decide or a judge?
Well, some of that remains to be seen. It may end up being part judge, part jury. It's too early to comment on that. There's a claim for nuisance, and there's a claim for false claims, and those are pretty complicated. We'll have to see how that shakes out. And I can't comment for the defendant on what they're going to do. Anytime we file a lawsuit, we plan on trying it, and that is our plan today. I welcome the opportunity for the public to see the evidence and see the truth. And, we'll just have to see how it shakes out. But as you can probably tell, I am a fervent believer in this lawsuit. I believe in this lawsuit with every fiber of my being. I've been, because I lost my son in 2002, I'm not a doctor, I'm a lawyer, but I've been reading everything I can get my hands on for 16 years on this and other drug addictions. And then when the opioid epidemic really got in full swing, I was following it very closely. There's nothing that I have said here today that's not in the media. I mean, it's all over the media. You can Google the opioid epidemic and you'll see everything that I've told you is out there. And I cannot speculate on, you know, what they're going to do, but they have denied liability. And I think they are pointing the finger at the doctors. And I think they're saying that people who get addicted are bad people. But, you know, we'll have to see how all that shakes out.
I want to shift gears here for a second. You talked about the loss of your son, Brandon, and how that has, changed your life and inspired you in this case. And in addition to the fact you started this group called Fighting Addiction Through Education, FATE, where you go around the state talking, you also, I met you through your foundation where you're doing work in Africa, where I met Sister Rosemary. Mm-hmm. Tell us how you got involved in that and what's involved in that activity.
Well, if you had told me when I, you know, was going to school in Seminole High School that I was going to grow up and my best friend would be a little nun from Africa, I would have said, you're crazy. I grew up in the Baptist church and I had no desire to go to Africa. My son died in February of 2002. And I was not doing well. I was extremely depressed, and I don't think I would have made it if some of my friends hadn't dragged me to Africa. And so in November of 2002, we went to Uganda. Some of my friends dragged me over there, and it was a very bad time. Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, that war was going on in full force, and so we went there, and we probably went further north than we were supposed to go. I wasn't really worried at that time because I was thoroughly and completely depressed and miserable. But we ended up going and seeing some of Sister Rosemary's children. She was openly defying Kony and taking these children in and protecting them. It's a miracle that he and his thugs didn't kill her. But she was putting up signs and going on the radio and telling children to come to her school and she would protect them. You know, there's no telling how many lives that she saved. So that was that was a real pivotal moment for my life because I told myself there are people that have it worse than me. These children have it far worse than me. And it was very helpful to my personal journey in recovering. And I came home and started a foundation, first Pros for Africa. And Pros for Africa essentially today works with colleges all over the state to send kids and students and professors over to Sister Rosemary's schools, and the kids and the professors volunteer. And we've got kids from OSU Med School, OU Med School, UCO, East Central, all over the state. We have quite a few children and teachers going over there all the time, and they get more out of it than the kids in Uganda, believe it or not.
Oh, no, I'm sure, yeah.
My daughter, who is a doctor here in Tulsa, is leaving tomorrow with a couple of other doctors for Uganda. And my youngest daughter, who's at OU now, is about to go in July. So it's a phenomenal experience. But Uganda today is totally different than it was in 2002. And, you know, at some point in time, we started supporting her school, and we started Pros for Africa, and we started another foundation called Sowing Hope. Ultimately, we made a movie that Forrest Whitaker did the voiceover, and it's, you can see that movie. It's called Sowing Hope. It's on our sowinghope.org, and you can see the movie on there. It's a great movie. It tells the story of Sister Rosemary's life. And so it's a very strange intersection there between the loss of my son due to addiction and me working with Sister Rosemary, but it's all true.
And so Sister Rosemary winds up coming to Tulsa or to Oklahoma. Is it a few times a year?
Yeah, about four or five times. She was here last week, as a matter of fact. And, you know, in 2002, it was questionable whether she would survive. And then Kony left in 2005. He's still somewhere. He's still out there and still a threat, even though they've tried to find him. What we've tried to do is find those children a place to call home. When Kony left, those children had nowhere to go. They missed the formative years of their schooling. So Sister Rosemary had to teach them trades like cooking, sewing, and things of that nature. And these kids had never seen a doctor before in their life. So we started getting med students and residents and professors at both of our med schools to go over there. And they go over a couple of times a year and hold free medical clinics. And it's just an incredible thing that we do for these kids. But we've kind of expanded that out to volunteers in other fields, lawyers, engineers, teachers. We have all kinds of professions that now go over to Sister Rosemary's schools. And I met you at the OSU Medical School Gala, and those kids are just enamored with Sister Rosemary. She's probably the top feminist speaker on the planet today. Nobody knew who she was in 2002. In 2007, she was a CNN hero. And then in 2014, Time Magazine nominated her as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. And so she's pretty famous today. And ultimately, we're hoping she'll end up getting nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize because she deserves it. She saved countless lives at great personal risk. I'm a big fan of Mother Teresa, but I don't think anybody was trying to kill Mother Teresa. And Rosemary was in great, great danger.
Reggie Whitten is a lawyer based out of Oklahoma City, and he is co-lead counsel in Oklahoma's lawsuit against opioid manufacturers. Reggie Whitten, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, John.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.